We finished at 1538. 1539 says, and when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus heard his cry and how he died, he said, surely this man was the Son of God. On a website called Right with Fay, I discovered an article that relates today to what we will be focusing on in this Good Friday sermon with the theme, The Secret is Revealed. Fay writes, revealing a character's secret is always fun and exciting. You can't wait to drop the massive bombshell and astound your readers. There are a few ways I can think of how a writer can reveal a character's secret. One, let your character blurt it out. And this is by far the easiest method and the one that will ensure the biggest shock to both your readers and your characters. Two, tell your readers but keep the secret from the other characters and let them uncover it on their own. Three, draw it out. This method utilizes suspense and mystery, but it also takes the most work because neither the characters nor your readers know the secret. But every secret must follow these three rules. Number one, the secret needs to relate to the story you're telling. It has to have a purpose. Two, the secret has to follow what the plot is already doing. It shouldn't all of a sudden divert from the plot and create another storyline. Three, the secret should tell your readers more about the character so they can understand him or her more, and it has to make sense with what they already know about the character. Whatever secret your character has, it has to influence the outcome of the story. I know he didn't, but I think that Mark could have easily read this article before he wrote his gospel, centered around that key literary context of the messianic secret. In our sermon so far in Lent concerning Jesus and the messianic secret, we saw firstly the demon-possessed man in the temple cry out, I know who you are, the Holy One of God. And Jesus commanded him to be quiet. Then on coming down the mountain with Peter, James, and John after the transfiguration, Jesus warned them, don't tell anyone about what you've seen. After Jesus had healed the leper, he said to him, don't tell this to anyone, but we know that he went and blabbed everybody and made it very difficult for Jesus to do his ministry in the urban areas. Then Jesus raised the 12-year-old daughter of Jairus from the dead, and he warned Jairus, don't let anyone know, even though there were professional mourners there who had seen the girl dead and then alive. Jesus warned the people who had seen the deaf and mute man healed, do not tell anyone. But the more he told them to say nothing, the more they spoke about it. And then last week we saw Peter and his disciples confess that Jesus was the Christ, the Messiah, but they didn't have any clue as to what it meant. So Jesus warned them, do not tell anyone about me. Well, as we've been looking at these six references to Jesus' identity being revealed, and his warning the demon in the first case, and then the various people in the rest to silence, we noted that the exorcisms and the healings Jesus did and the transfiguration were only signposts as to who he was as the Messiah. They were not the ultimate proof, and it was not the time or the place for his kingship to be revealed. Last week, we came close to the secret being revealed when Peter said, "You are the Christ, the Messiah," but because they had no idea that Jesus was meant to be a suffering Messiah, and they had in mind that he would be a glorious conquering king in whom they would share some of the glory, they were near, but yet so far. But today, as we come to the foot of the cross on this first Good Friday, written about in Mark's Gospel, we come to the right place, the right time, the right revealer, and the right kind of Messiah that Jesus was. And it's all encapsulated in our key text. "And when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus heard his cry and saw how he died, he said, 'Surely this man was the Son of God.'" That's it. That's the secret revealed. So let's look at that day in a little more detail. What did the centurion see and hear that day that led him to make the confession that truly, or surely, this man was the Son of God? Well, at the sixth hour, darkness came over the whole land until the ninth hour. Now, in the Jewish program, 6 a.m. was the first hour of the day, when the day began. And so the sixth hour was midday, and the ninth hour was 3 p.m. And as you know, at midday, the sun is at its highest point in the sky. But that day, sunlight was not seen. It grew dark. And this wasn't an eclipse or a natural occurrence. What does this darkness indicate? Well, in Mark's Gospel, we've been observing the battle between Jesus, the clean one, and the unclean powers of darkness, of the demon, sickness, and death. And there on the cross, the battle reaches its peak. There had been strong traditions about supernatural signs appearing in the sky at the birth or death of a great person. But what Mark probably has in mind here is the end, as predicted by himself in Mark 13, 24 and 25, when he said, "But in those days following that distress, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from the sky, and the heavenly bodies will be shaken." You see, Jesus' death brings humanity and all human history to its end and goal. With his resurrection, a new time and a new humanity will begin. So in creation, light comes forward out of darkness. And so we'll see a similar thing then on Resurrection Sunday morning. At the ninth hour, Jesus is in the depths of the battle with the unclean forces and demonic powers. Crying out in a loud voice is the language of possession by an unclean spirit and exorcism, as we have already seen in Mark. Here in the darkest hour, the Son of Man, the truly human one, is possessed by all that is unclean, all that is demonic. He bears the unclean powers in his body, in his spirit. The battle is so deep, so dark, so difficult, that he cries out in a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani." Aramaic, as we have seen Mark use before, which is meant to draw us right into the story as if we were there. In English, it is, my God, why have you forsaken me?" The battle with all the combined forces of sin, death, and the devil that is, was, and will be upon the cross is so deep, so dark, so difficult that Jesus loses all sense of the Father's presence and cries out in God-forsakenness. And when some of those standing near heard this, they said, "Listen, he's calling Elijah." And a man ran and filled a sponge with wine vinegar, put it on a stick, and offered it to Jesus to drink. "Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down," he said. The bystanders are blind. They do not see. They misunderstand Eloi, my God, for the name Elijah. They think he's calling on the one in whom Israel hopes for the messianic age to come. And so that Jesus would last a little bit longer and they could see if Elijah would come down for him, they cynically send a man to put wine vinegar on a stick and offer it to Jesus to drink, because wine vinegar had anesthetic properties. But Elijah never came down. A legion of angels never came to fight the battle for him. The Father remained silent. And with a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. A more accurate translation there is uttering a loud cry instead of with a loud cry. The word for uttering is literally leaving or letting go. And the loud cry is literally expels a spirit. It is characteristic of a demon being expelled. Now, don't for a minute think that I'm saying that Jesus was demon-possessed. But the battle with the unclean spirits and the demonic powers took place deep within his body, deep within his spirit. And when he died, he cried out, exorcising the unclean enemies of sin, death, and the devil, and breaking their dehumanizing powers. The devil is defeated. Death no longer has the last say, and sin is not the ultimate power on earth. The clean one has rendered the unclean ones powerless. And as one of my seminary lecturers used to say, they had their teeth taken out upon the cross, but they can only gum you now. Jesus' death tears the curtain of the temple in two, from top to bottom, from heaven down to earth. This was God's doing. And this was probably the curtain that separated the most holy place where God lived on earth with his people from the holy place. The tearing of this curtain from top to bottom was a sign that this was God's doing. That because Jesus died, people were now free to have access to God. There was no need for priests, no need for sacrifices. The highest of all priests became the Lamb, which was the acceptable sacrifice for our sins and for all, once and for all. Jesus' death and the tearing of the curtain foretold the end of the temple system that was to happen in 70 AD with the Roman invasion of Jerusalem. Now, the Roman centurion wouldn't have heard about the tearing of the temple curtain, but he saw and heard everything else, even though he didn't understand what was going on in the background. And he said, "Surely this man was the Son of God." Now, this is quite amazing. We know that a centurion had command of 100 soldiers. He was probably a much traveled and highly experienced soldier whose responsibility would have been to see to executions and also keep a tight rein over the men under his command. More importantly, he would have taken part in ceremonies in which the Roman emperor was honored as a divine being. The Romans practice a ritual that's called a triumph. Let me tell you about it. It demonstrated the link between the emperor and the gods of Zeus, Jupiter, and Mars. The emperor would pay off the Praetorian Guard to make a big show. After a battle was won, the soldiers would place a crown of laurel on the emperor's head, and they would begin a processional from the field of Mars to the Capitoline Hill in Rome. And once there, the emperor would ascend the stairs of the Temple of Saturn. And while doing all of this, the soldiers would cry out, "Hail the Son of God! Hail the Son of God!" And the crowd would cheer. And at the temple, two men would greet him. One would tell him that he is the Son of God, and the other one would tell him that he was just mortal. And the emperor would then pour out a goblet of wine on the ground as an offering to the gods, and then an animal sacrifice would be made in order to thank the gods for the victory of the victory in battle, and Rome would feast for the rest of the day. So think about that. For that Roman centurion to say that the crucified Jesus was the Son of God was the equivalent to treason. He was a traitor. You wouldn't make a confession like that unless you were sure in your very heart of what you saw and heard. That would have been a real surprise to those first readers and hearers of Mark's Gospel for something like that to have happened. The Anglican theologian N.T. Wright says that the Roman centurion becomes the first sane human being in Mark's Gospel to call Jesus God's Son and mean it. "Yes," says Mark, to his possibly Roman audience, "and if him, why not more? Why not more of you Romans?" God's own pronouncement about Jesus, "He is my Son," that we heard him say at Jesus' baptism and the transfiguration, is now seen to be true by a Gentile soldier. This thing is possible only when one stands at the foot of the cross. Only when one stands at the cross does one stand in the presence of God, the Holy One. The cross is God's answer to Jesus' question, "Who do you say that I am?" The cross replaces the temple as the ladder between heaven and earth, between God and people. The sacrificial worship and the activities in the temple are replaced by the Son of God himself, who gives his own body and his own blood to feed his new community, which is made up of people of all nations. This confession of who Jesus is in the mouth of the Gentile Roman soldier, and the splitting of the temple curtain in two from top to bottom, opens the way for those who were once outsiders, the Gentiles, the non-Jews, to become insiders, to become people of God. It no longer relied on race. The grace of God in Jesus Christ splits that long-standing division in humanity asunder. So then, the cross is the right place for the Messiah to be revealed. It is only at the cross that you can know the Messiah for who he really is, a suffering and dying king. It's only at the cross that you can know him as the right type of Messiah that he is, not a glorious, victorious, all-conquering military king who takes on the Romans and defeats them, but rather a suffering, dying king who takes on the powers of sin, death, and the devil on the cross, all of those unclean powers, and there he defeats them, for his is a kingdom of hearts. At the cross was the right time for him to be revealed as the Messiah. All of the other actions of healing, of exorcism, of raising the dead, only preempted that day. If on the basis of these actions he was made king, we would only have a miracle worker as a king, but not the conqueror of the powers of darkness. His cross is the throne of this king. It is on the cross that his kingship is truly revealed. He can only be known as king on the cross, because it is there that all people can come to confess this man was the Son of God. This is the messianic secret revealed in Mark's Gospel. It is found in the mouth of a Gentile soldier, because Jesus is King, the Son of David, the Son of God, for all people. He makes the unclean clean, and he brings the outsiders and in and makes them insiders. So my friends, this is the gospel, the good news, for all the world to see and hear. Now we are free to tell others about it. The secret is now revealed. Truly, this man was the Son of God. Amen.